Good afternoon. You're very welcome to today's edition of Saturday with Clare Byrne. On today's programme, some people pay for everything and others get everything for free. Leo Varadkar sets out his stall ahead of the battle to lead Fine Gael. A million breath tests that never happened and wrongful convictions that could cost us millions. Can Noreen O'Sullivan continue as head of the Garda Síochána? And the bus strike. Can a political solution work? Or is Shane Ross right to stick to his guns and stay out of it? All of that to come with our panel, but first it's time for the news now with Susan Jackson. Susan, thank you very much. This is Saturday with Clare Byrne and we'd like to hear from you over the course of the next hour. You can text us 51551, email saturday at rte.ie and on Twitter at SaturdayRTE. Joining us today in our studio, we've Minister Leo Varadkar, Fine Gael TD and Minister for Social Protection, Willie O'Dea, Fianna Fáil TD and spokesperson on Social Protection, Breed Smith, Solidarity TD, Fia Kelly, Irish Times political correspondent and Dan O'Brien, who's a columnist with the Irish Independent and the Sunday Independent and also chief economist with the Institute of International and European Affairs. Now, before we get started, I just want to let you know that next Saturday we're going to be coming live from Dundalk, where we'll be discussing Brexit and its effect on the border, trade and on the economic and political future of this country. And we'll be joined there by Minister Charlie Flanagan, Gerry Adams TD and President of Sinn Féin, Stephen Donnelly of Fianna Fáil and Geoffrey Donaldson, DUP MP, among others. And they're going to debate all of those issues in front of a live audience. If you'd like to be part of that audience at the Oriel Centre in Dundalk, then email us saturday at rte.ie and we'd be delighted to welcome you there on the day. But today, I suppose starting with the big news, if you like, it's the story of the Gardaí, which is moving along as we speak, because Taoiseach Enda Kenny, speaking in Rome, has expressed his confidence in Noreen O'Sullivan, despite what's happened over the course of the last few days. But she is making a statement later today. Fiach, perhaps you might take us through where we're at right now with this story.
Yeah, I think the Taoiseach has just spoken in Rome, where he is for the EU 60 celebrations, as you said. There is a sense that perhaps there's a growing impatience in the body politic with the Garda Commissioner and the Guards in general because of this story that broke about. We were told previously that there were a million breath tests carried out between 2 million between 2012 and 2016. It actually transpired, so there were only a million. And 147 people were wrongly given summons when they'd already paid their fixed charge notices. This only came to light in recent days. Actually, it was reported in the Irish Times by my colleague David Labani a number of weeks ago, but the Guards confirmed it in recent days. And I suppose what's happened...
And where do you get the sense that there's frustration within Fine Gael, for example, with Noreen O'Sullivan?
Well, the tone of the comments that Taoiseach made, as were played out on the bulletin about an hour or so ago, are more hardline than I have heard from him on the Guards in a while. Now, he did say, I have confidence in the Commissioner, but there is an element of frustration creeping in. And I think the difference with this particular controversy, unlike the previous ones where we talk about whistleblowers, it's various people's differing accounts of things that may or not have transpired. This is quite evidently some sort of incompetence about how the Guards administered the penalty point system. And we heard Willie's colleague, Jim O'Callaghan, on the radio yesterday kind of giving qualified confidence to Noreen O'Sullivan, saying he would have confidence in her if she addresses these issues within a week. And the Taoiseach again saying this afternoon that he has confidence in her, but he expects her to outline the full explanation for this today at some stage.
What can she say, though? Like, Willie, what can Noreen O'Sullivan say? It's a farce. A million breath tests that didn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't hear the Taoiseach's interview today, but I had the Minister for Justice and I found it a little curious, to say the least, that both of them have expressed confidence in the Commissioner in advance of hearing what she has to say. I mean, both those matters are quite indefensible. I mean, the law is quite clear. If people get a penalty point, a fixed fine notice, they can't be brought to court. I mean, that's the reality. Now, I think Feek mentioned a figure of 147. Actually, it's 14,700 people who were actually brought to court and convicted wrongly.
Well, 146 were wrongly summoned, and of those, 14,700, I think, had an additional charge or some.
No, I think basically 146,000, as far as I know, summonses went out in error. So you know, I mean, I listened carefully to the conference, the press conference the other day, and I mean, we were told that, look, you know, it's a question, it's systems failure, it's this, it's that, and then in relation to the breath tests, where there was a million extra ghost breath tests, we were told that there would be an inquiry under a superintendent, and that Garda management said that they couldn't confirm whether or not the contents of that inquiry would be made public. Now, look, I mean, I want to say this as clearly as I possibly can. That's not good enough. That is not good enough. I mean, the position is that the commissioner, who is the head of the Garda force, she's the person with whom the buck stops. She has to give a clear and plausible explanation for both these debacles, and she had, well, we said she had to do so within a week. If the Taoiseach wants her to do it today, so much the better. But we listen carefully to what she says and we'll make our decision accordingly.
Mm-hmm. The Examiner this morning as well were reporting that the number of checkpoints that were set up, this is according to a recently retired guard who has made a statement on this and spoken to the Garda Inspectorate, that the number of checkpoints set up was exaggerated as well. So if you plan to do 10 checkpoints, you just fill in a form and you put in the pulse system that you'd done the 10, even if you'd only done 5.
Yeah, well, you see, look, I mean,
and he was told when he said that to his superiors, that's the way it's done.
That's the way it's done. I mean, nobody can stand over that. I mean, you know, look, it seems to me that there is a system. The medical bureau have a system of calculating exactly how many breath tests were done. But apparently, what the guard did was the guard, when he went back to the station or sometime thereafter, he estimated how many people he had actually pulled and tested, and it was obviously they exaggerated the amount they had done. But what I've noticed is this is not isolated. I mean, we've had understated crime figures, we've had overstated detection figures. All the incorrect statistics that are coming out seem to be in favour of the Gardaí. Mm-hmm. Now, this is just indefensible, because government policy in the justice area is informed to a large extent on these statistics, and we must have confidence in those statistics, and we're entitled to have, and the public are entitled to have confidence in those statistics.
Dan O'Brien, you wanted to come in there.
That Examiner report today, you know, it said the guard who made this, who raised the breathalyzer thing, he said, and I'm quoting the paper, I was dismissed and my concerns were dismissed and I was criticised from top management. Now that suggests that management is sending out a signal to misrecord what's going on. Now, that's an extremely serious thing. You know, that's not a farce. That is an extremely serious thing. When a million false tests are put into a system, you know, that's not just a few bad apples. That is a systemic problem. And, you know, as the deputy said, the guards have form in this. Like, the CSO had to pull the official crime statistics because they were just so unreliable on the basis of the raw data they were getting from the guards. Like, this is a very, very serious issue.
And yet the Taoiseach says today that he has confidence in the Garda Commissioner. Breeze, you give us your take and then we'll turn to Leo Bradker.
Just on that, I think that the Taoiseach may be saying today he has confidence in the Garda Commissioner, but I think it's going to be not long before she's going to be forced to step down, because this is clearly, as was said here, a systemic issue. It's across all districts and across all areas. It's not just one or two bad apples. It's the whole barrel is rotten, and that has to be dealt with. And it's clearly a decision was made that this is how we're going to do things, and this is how we're going to apply, how we collate and collect and record our data. And it has huge implications for the individuals who were brought to court, haven't paid their fines, massive implications for their personal lives and being out of pocket and having to have child money. There's been horror stories already on chat shows about it. But then on the
Well, you
figures,
may have lost a job. You may have not been offered a job because of this conviction.
Absolutely.
That was wrongly visited upon you.
And I hope those people are able to get retribution from the state for the damage
but
that was done
to them.
From the
state? That's us. We have to pay for this. We have to pay for this.
I know it's us, but they're still entitled to it and we have to pay for it. But ultimately, that is why I think it is of such a serious nature that the Garda Commissioner and possibly other people will have to be stepped down and a major investigation into it. But then there's also ramifications for the breathalyzing scandal, because the Road Safety Authority, how can they rely on the figures from the Gardaí? How can they plan to help to decrease the numbers of deaths on the road? 40% of deaths on the roads are alcohol related. So there's huge implications mm-hmm. for this. So
the Medical Bureau of Road Safety, this is the Irish Times, isn't it, Fiacc, mm-hmm. today, they told the Gardaí about the breath test problem in 2014 because they realised that the number of tests claimed seemed to be carried out was higher than the number of those plastic disposable mouthpieces purchased and needed for the test. So they go to the guards and they say, you must need more of those plastic mouthpieces. And the guardies say, no, we have stockpiles of them. And we only hear about it now. Minister, what's your view on all of this and on expressions of confidence from your colleague, Minister Francis Fitzgerald and the Taoiseach?
Well, I think the whole thing is appalling. I think it's not acceptable, and I think that there needs to be accountability. And unfortunately, it's not all that surprising, because this is just one of a number of scandals now relating to the Gardaí over the last couple of years. When I was Minister for Transport and had responsibility for road safety, we would meet the Gardaí regularly, a senior Gardaí management, and we were quite sceptical about a lot of the things we're being told about when it came to enforcement levels, you know, roadside checks, the numbers they were giving us. And of course, the Medical Bureau of Road Safety was under our remit.
So what did you do about it then?
The main thing that we took them up on, of course, was the whole issue of penalty point fixing. That became the main issue that we had to confront the Gardaí on, was that whole issue that arose from the fact that people's penalty points, our penalty points were being squared, is the term that was used at the time, you know, cancelled effectively. And everyone knows what happened in the years since about that. We could never really particularly get to the bottom of disputing whether the checks they were claiming were happening were actually happening or not. But anecdotally, everyone was telling us that the checks were less frequent and the statistics being produced by Garda management were otherwise. So obviously, as a government, we're expecting a statement from the Garda Commissioner today. As the Taoiseach said, we want to make sure that's very clear. It's been interesting that when you listen to Garda representatives over the last couple of months, they always tell us how much work the Gardaí do. It now seems they claim to do work that they don't do. And that's a real issue for me, I think, because they just don't have credibility.
Have you confidence in Noreen O'Sullivan?
I do have confidence in Noreen O'Sullivan. The reason why I do is because when it does come to these two issues, bear in mind, first of all, she was appointed in an open competition, the first Garda commissioner appointed in that way. And since she's come into office, she has actually put the solutions in place to deal with these two issues, and they are quite different by the way, and we don't expect that it'll be 14,000 convictions that are overturned. It'll probably be closer to a third of that, because sometimes people had other convictions as well, and she has put in place the solutions to this, but we need to now make sure that, having put those solutions in place,
and the breath tests, do you accept or do you believe that solutions have been put in place? She's been there since 2014. This was going on up to 2016.
Yeah, a solution has been put in place, but we now need to make sure that it's verified. And you know, given the history of what we've been told by Garda management, anything that's, when we're told that a solution has to be put in place, we now need to check that it has been put in place and that needs to be verified.
So if she says today a solution has been put in place and it's a verifiable solution, you're happy for her to stay in the job?
Yes, but we will verify it. And we have to do that. And one of the big reforms that the Taoiseach to Francis Fitzgerald has brought in is the establishment of a Garda authority to hold the Gardaí to account. And I think the statement from Josephine Feely, from the chairman of that authority, has been very clear and didn't pull any punches. She said very clearly this was not some sort of clerical error or mathematical issue or some sort of logarithm. This was an ethical issue that people were, you know, ethical means people were putting false information.
Well, she talks about this being further evidence of deep cultural problems within the Garda service.
Yes, and she's the chairman of the Garda authority, an authority established by this government to hold the Gardaí to account, and she's the chairman appointed by this government, and we stand by her in the work she's doing, and I think you're going to see a very robust engagement between the Garda authority and the commissioner and Garda senior management. But this does actually speak to a bigger issue, and is the whole issue of individual accountability in the senior public service. It's not just the Gardaí, it's the HSC, it's other parts of government and the public service too. And pretty much the only senior people in Ireland, in the broader public service, that are ever held to account are politicians. TDs can lose their seats, and they do. Ministers of State can be dismissed by the Cabinet, and ministers can be dismissed by the Taoiseach. It's almost impossible to hold individuals in senior positions across state agencies to account, and that's not the case in other countries. You know, much as we may dislike him, Donald Trump in America, by executive order, can fire people if they're above a certain level.
And yet you're saying you have confidence in the Garda commissioner.
In police services in the United States, for example, people not only lose their jobs, they lose their pensions too. And we don't have those kind of sanctions in Ireland. We can't do that particular one, by the way, for a particular reason. But we do need to actually grasp the nettle of individual accountability in senior parts of the public service. And I'm frustrated as somebody who's been in government, by the way, for 6 years, that we haven't actually grasped that nettle, and I think we need to.
But okay. Leo, I mean, I know you're maintaining that you trust Noreen O'Sullivan on this issue, and that there's checks and balances in place, and that you'll make sure that they're implemented and that they're correct and above board. But following hot on the heels of the McCabe case and the Garda whistleblowers, do you not think it's time to say this is too far and too much, and we can't have a Garda commissioner that stays in place when all of these flawed systems, whistleblower scandals, etc., are piling on top of each other, and the people, more importantly, whatever about the politicians, are losing confidence in the police that are supposed to keep law and order in the country? There's a huge drop in the level of confidence and trust in the Garda Síochána among the ordinary people. And somewhere along the line, we have to show that we're seriously going to clean up the act of the law enforcers to make it credible for ordinary people to stomach again.
Yeah, I suppose the answer to that question is do I believe that Noreen O'Sullivan is part of the problem or part of the solution? And I think principally she's part of the solution. She is relatively newly appointed. She's the first person appointed in an open competition. And she's the one who has put in place in the last number of months or in the last year the solution.
But Leo, can I just come back to Josephine Feely's statement again? Further evidence of deep cultural problems within the Garda service. You're dealing with somebody who is part of that culture. Couldn't be anything else but because she is... She's a lifer.
But it's her part of her remit now to change that culture. And, you know, I don't think that it'd be right to suggest that all Gardaí, whether at management level or rank and file, necessarily like the culture and the kind of practice and cavalierism that exists in the Gardaí. Lots of Gardaí that I would know, some of whom are whistleblowers, by the way, are very uncomfortable with that culture and want to change it.
Okay, Willie, you want to come in and then come back.
Just one technical point there in relation to the magnitude of the problem in relation to the convictions. You see, the Gardaí are making the point that sometimes somebody would have to go to court anyway because there's a number of other charges. But nevertheless, the Gardaí are going to have to go back to court in those cases as well to get rid of that particular charge. So we're talking about 15,000. And as Breed has said, you know, some people, I know one person who claims they've lost a job on account of this. People have got, you know, their penalty points have probably been put off the road. They reached 12 penalty points as a result, and various other implications. And no doubt it's going to cost the state quite a lot of money. It's unquantifiable at the moment. It's not going to cost Noreen O'Sullivan or the senior Garda officers any money. And with the taxpayers, at a time when you know, cancer operations are being cancelled, when people are lying in trolleys for days, I mean, this is going to cost tens of millions, and somebody must be accountable. And I agree. I mean, Noreen O'Sullivan is the head of the Garda force. I mean, I'd say now a fairly quick examination will reveal who else is responsible for this debacle. And I think they should face consequences also.
I think it's quite extraordinary to have the former Minister for Transport, who's going to be competing for leadership of his party and the leadership of the country in the coming weeks, saying that he didn't believe what Garda officers were telling him across the table when he was going through statistics, that he said it didn't have credibility. He said he couldn't believe that they were doing the work they told a minister of the government they were doing. Dan has alluded to the fact that the CSO doesn't believe the statistics the guards are giving him. And you are right that it's a cultural issue within the guards, Josephine Feely has said. And perhaps the solution to it is to bring in someone from the outside, not someone from within the ranks of the force to run the force, perhaps an outsider. And that was initially the intent of the last process that was set up during the previous government, that it was hoped that there would be an outsider who would come in to run the guards. It didn't transpire. But you would hope that when Noreen O'Sullivan steps aside, that someone can be brought in who doesn't have the attachments to it as a cultural institution, has to run it as an organisation that can be run effectively.
Mm-hmm. Michael Clifford, writing today, Willie, says that the body politic is nicely compliant with the story that all of this rests with a few bad apples in the force. He was referring back to Robert Troy's response during the week when he refused to condemn Noreen O'Sullivan. Now, that position seemed to have changed with what Jim O'Callaghan said yesterday. Was there discussion in the party about changing your position on Noreen O'Sullivan?
We've had informal discussions in relation to the matter, and the position is as outlined by Jim O'Callaghan yesterday.
That she has a week.
And repeated by me now that she has a week, and the explanations will have to be plausible, otherwise we are going to lose confidence in her.
Mm-hmm. But Fianna Fáil have been tiptoeing towards this position for some time. If you remember when the recent McCabe controversy was at its height, Micheál Martin arrived in this formal of words that said, when it was put to him, do you have confidence in Noreen O'Sullivan? The default answer previously, yes, I do, was No, Leo Varadkar just said, he then said Noreen O'Sullivan's position is a matter for herself, and you got the impression that Fianna Fáil wanted her to resign but didn't want to push her, perhaps for fear of losing some of the Garda vote, but they're obviously moving towards a more definitive point of view regarding the Garda Commissioner
well,
now.
I don't know about losing the Garda vote. I mean, the fact of the matter is we were extremely annoyed by what we learned in relation to the McCabe matter, and now we've got two other debacles, and you know, the question is, how much can you take? I mean, as I say, as Jim O'Callaghan, who speaks for us on justice, said, she has to have a plausible explanation. And it's not just good enough to say that I've now put verifiable solutions in place. We have to have some explanation as to how this happened. Some plausible explanation.
What can that plausible explanation be? I'm at a loss to know how you can explain away a million tests that didn't happen.
What was wrong with the system that allowed this sort of thing to happen? I mean, why, for example, were the Gardaí allowed at their own behest to put those things into pulse on their own without any supervision or without any verification?
Well, it's clearly an instruction this is a method, this is how you do it, procedure.
Because
it goes across all districts.
If that is the case, then we've got a real problem. So, look, let's find out what she says. Let's see what she says. We're prepared to give her her chance to explain the situation, and we will study her explanation and we'll make a decision accordingly.
Dan, last word to you.
Just, look, it's not just a cultural thing. And let's just say, I think, you know, in fairness, there's nobody here from the Guards, and that most of us, I think, have good experiences with the Guards, and most Guards are fine, upstanding people. But it's not just a cultural thing. And if you want evidence of that, just have a look at some of the reports the Garda Inspectorate have written, hundreds of pages. Goes through, you know, not just culture issues, but management issues, performance issues. You know, this is an organization that is dysfunctional, and the hundreds of pages in Garda Inspectorate reports show that from top to bottom, there are real problems about how the organization functions.
So, how do you solve it then?
Well, the report sets out very clearly what needs to be done. And those reports are, you know, there's a lot of frustration between the lines in those reports because management isn't doing it. And the reports clearly say, the inspectorate says, ultimately it is up to the senior management of the Garda to implement reform.
Do you have a view on Noreen O'Sullivan and her position?
Look, it's easy for a commentator to come in and say people should resign. But, you know, it's getting to a point where, you know, not just this issue, but, you know, huge systemic issues across the force, that something needs to be done.
Okay, well, we await the statement. I'm not sure what time we're expecting it or whether we've got any information on when it's coming through. But if it happens in the next half an hour or 35 minutes, we'll bring it to you. More after this break. Welcome back to the programme. We have Willie O'Dea from Fianna Fáil, Minister Leo Varadkar, Breed Smith, Solidarity TD, Fia Kelly from the Irish Times, and Dan O'Brien, who writes for INM and is also Chief Economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs. And we turn to the Irish Independent and the lead today, Leo Varadkar's declaration on the future of taxation. The headline is, I'll cut taxes on middle incomes. Fia, you've got it in front of you there. I'm just trying to read upside down, but that is what it says, isn't it? You get the front page. Leo, is this the first shot in the leadership battle that isn't happening yet?
Sure, Claire. Everything I say and do and think and don't think for the last year and a half now has
well,
been...
you're not writing it for the good of your health. Come on.
I'm setting out a view that I've held for a very long time, and actually to a certain extent I've set out before in previous speeches and articles, but essentially what I'm saying is that overall in Ireland our tax base isn't too big, our taxes aren't too high, but when it comes to personal taxation in Ireland for a lot of people is too high. And very briefly I'm setting out four principles. First principle, that everyone should contribute something, even if it's something very small, but we should pay according to our means, that the government should never take more than 50% of any euro you earn, and I explain the reasons for that, that we need tax equality for the self-employed. It's unfair that self-employed people are expected to pay more tax than people who are in regular employment, and also that we should expand social insurance, that we should merge the USC with PRSI, and that's for two reasons. First of all, it applies the contributory principle, the idea that you contribute into the system and you get something in return, but it directly links the contributions you pay to return in terms of services. And that's one of the things I think that really works very well about PRSI, which is under my remit.
You're not saying cut USC. You're saying combine it with PRSI.
What I am saying fundamentally is you merge USC into PRSI and you create a new social insurance. But in return for that, you expand the benefits that people get in return for that.
So would it be at the same high level as USC and PRSI are separately now?
that obviously the detail has to be worked out, but one thing that it won't be is so high that anyone pays over 50% of any euro they earn in tax and PRSI. And that is the case at the moment.
But the cut will come to the income tax rate rather than to the combined USC PRSI rate.
To the marginal rate, because we're in a situation now where our high marginal rate, the fact that people have to pay more than 50 cents of the last euro they earn, or many euros they earn, is creating real problems for people, for middle class, middle income earners who are getting a small pay increase, some pay restoration in the next couple of weeks, who get a promotion into overtime. They have to give more than 50% of that back to the government. And I think that's unfair, and I think it's a disincentive to people. And also it's becoming an issue now in the battle for talent. We're trying to retain highly qualified people here in Ireland. We're trying to bring them in from overseas. We're trying to attract jobs from London as a consequence of Brexit. And this is one of the big issues that we're coming up against.
The taxes are too
high.
That
they're so out of line with other countries and competitors.
And tell me, you say taxpayers pay for everything while others get everything for free. Who are the others?
What I say is there's a risk that we could divide our society, and this is what some people want, and some people in the left, for example, particularly want this, is the idea that, you know, the middle class and better off people should pay for everything and potentially get nothing in return, and that there should be another group in society that gets everything for free.
Who are they? People who are on social welfare for their lifetime? Those
not
people?
Not necessarily, no, because people who are on social welfare can be on social welfare for all sorts of diverse reasons. People with disabilities, for example, and pensioners, for example. But, you know, I would be of the view that anyone who can contribute something should do so. I'm not.
Do we have a culture in this country of people who can contribute but who don't?
I think we have a risk of moving in that direction. If we take more and more people out of the social insurance system, out of the tax system, and then load the burden of taxation entirely on the middle class, and the better off, then you will create a divided society of people who pay nothing out of their personal income into the system, and have an expectation that they should get services in return but not pay for them, and then another group who feel they're paying 50% or more of their income in taxes and social insurance but getting nothing in return. But there's one very important part of this, and I hope it's understood, is what I'm advocating is a move to a much more European model where we pay lower income tax rates, but much more social insurance. And in return for social insurance, you get benefits. So, for example, we brought in paternity benefit last year for the first time. We increased all the benefits in the last couple of weeks. We're restoring things like treatment benefit during the course of this year. And that could go a lot further. In France, for example, people get a lot of their medical bills refunded through the social insurance system.
All right, we'll tease out a lot of those issues, but Breed Smith is beside you and she's just shy of hopping out of her chair.
Big change,
Yeah, as one of those people before profit lefties who believe that there is a big divide in this society between those who pay everything and those who pay nothing. I actually agree with Leo on that, but I locate the divide at those who pay nothing are Apple, for example, who owe us 13 billion and who this government are spending at least a million in fancy lawyers' fees to appeal the decision for Apple not to pay us the money. It's probably even more like 18 and 19 billion when you add in the interest. And those who pay very low, very, very low corporation tax, and those who pay no wealth tax. And indeed, there's a whole plethora of billionaires and millionaires whose presence is growing in this country, who pay very little and expect everything back for them. And when I say expect everything back, they expect everything back in forms of lax labour laws, reduced sort of contracts for workers, which we'll come to it later on. But at the heart of the Busairn dispute, this is the sort of issue that's there. Take down wages, reduce the type of contracts people work on, give them more precarious and flexible contracts, make more profits for the bosses, and then they don't pay their taxes on those profits.
So do you think that Leo needs
to think about who isn't actually paying their fair share? Are those at the top?
Okay,
yeah, let me answer that for a second. I think this is the typical socialist fantasy that gets trotted out by people like Breed and others, that they think that they can run our country and run our public services by taxing billionaires who don't live here and corporations who made their profits somewhere else. That's a load of nonsense. The only way you can fund and run a country and provide decent services and decent benefits for people is that if everyone contributes into the system and does so.
Do you not agree to a certain extent, though? Because I think you do make the point that we have competitive corporate tax rates, but personal tax rates are way out of kilter.
The margin rates, yeah,
so there you
very
go.
Much out of kilter.
Is that some common ground there between the two of you?
What are you trying to create a new movement?
I'm trying to create harmony. The sun is shining. Come on.
A new coalition.
Well, I'm
stuck for words. No, the point I'm making, though, about our corporation profit tax is that actually it works. And if you look at the amount of revenue that we bring in as a country,
Works for the corporations, Leo.
No, it actually works for the exchequer. Works for the exchequer as well. If you actually look at what we bring in,
figure that I looked at earlier on. In 2007, 20% of all revenue in this country came from income tax. In 2012, it was 42%, and it's gone up even more since. So that means that less of the overall share of the tax take is coming from the very, very wealthy, is coming from the corporations,
that's not
and
why
is coming
happened.
From the millionaires and the billionaires at the top.
Why that happened principally was a collapse in stamp duty.
It isn't because we were taking so much from all sorts of figures. That we, and you know, Europe have a problem with us for this, that we don't take enough tax from the corporations. Europe have a problem with it. We're going to be pulled into line. The days of being a tax haven and being able to get away with it are coming to an end. And that is not because the lefties are on the rise all over the place. That is because the world is saying you can't keep doing this. It's unfair. It's uncompetitive.
Okay. Let's see what Will O'Dea thinks.
Because the lefties are on the rise and we're going to have a redistribution of the wealth, and maybe that will happen. If you look at what Macron, for example, is advocating
Europe are not copying us. Europe are going to put manners on right now.
Will O'Dea, I want to come back to the substantive point, because you had previously said that Leo Varadkar was the most hands-off minister in recent times. You must be very pleased to see him now getting his hands dirty and investing in taxation policy and setting out his stall.
Well, I read Leo's manifesto this morning.
Leo's manifesto, that's a good ring to it.
Some interest. And, you know, there are things in it I agree with, of course. I mean, I do agree that, you know, very high marginal rates of tax in excess of 50% do serve as a disincentive. There's no doubt about that. And I also think that, you know, people come into the higher tax rate here for a single person, under 34,000. I mean, that's, you know, that should be changed. But you know, I have to confess, now Leo says, and I want to be fair to him, that he has to tease out the details of this as yet, but what he seems to be saying there in response to you, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that you reduce personal income tax, but you sort of increase the social insurance.
Is that a higher figure than it is now? No, it's not.
I'm clearly indicating that
it's not a lower figure.
Overall payroll taxes will go down, particularly the marginal rate. But instead of abolishing the USC outright, what I prefer to see is it merged with PRSI, but people getting real benefits in return for nothing for USC. But the problem, for social insurance, you actually get benefits.
Yeah, but the problem, Leo, you see, is that we're still talking about the same pool of money. So, you know, if you merge PRSI with USC and you have a fixed amount of income tax or even slightly less income tax, where are you going to get the money to expend the benefits? I mean, it's going to have to come from other public services then, with the same volume of money, if that's what you're saying. I don't see how you're going to expand
more
the benefits
people
unless you
will
do
pay
so.
Social insurance.
Does that mean more people will pay social insurance
anyway, because employment is rising and incomes are rising, and that's where the space comes from. And we have a constant supply agreement with Fianna Fáil for the next number of budgets, which does provide for both some reduction in taxation and increases in money for services.
And a massive increase in corporation tax
Wait
till you see Willie O'Dea now, he'll turn really left.
Well, look, I still don't think, I mean, the fact remains, okay, I mean, you know, you can depend on a growing economy. I mean, that's true in any scenario. I mean, if you have economic growth, you can expand and you can increase benefits, of course. But if you're not talking about raising tax, if you're talking about raising the same amount of tax by a different system, I don't see how you can expand benefits except by taking it from other public services like the health service, mm-hmm. etc. Mm-hmm. But just one or two points. I mean, on universal social charge, I mean, the late Brian Lenihan introduced universal social charge on the basis that an awful lot of people had actually been taken completely out of the income tax net. And he thought that perhaps, the theory was, at least, was that those people should be asked to contribute something.
He believed everybody should pay something.
Everybody should
Everyone
pay
who
something.
Could.
And there was
something.
No party, there was nobody in the Dáil that opposed that more vociferously than Fine Gael.
But government policies changed that first, since then.
When it was first introduced. Now, Inda has said that he's given a commitment that USC will be phased out by 2021. We all know that's impossible. Mm. I mean, there'll be too large a hole in revenue. But our policy on the USC is to try to ease it and gradually eliminate it for lower, first of all, and then middle income earners, you know, to do it in a progressive way. Okay. That's our policy.
Was Brian Lennon wrong then to make sure everybody paid something? Something.
Well, no. What I'm saying is that was the theory.
That
yeah, that is the that is
but
the theory.
But everybody does pay something.
It was the theory of the USC that everybody would pay something, and successful
what
ones
I'm
have brought people.
In direct taxation, through social insurance, because people understand that social insurance is money that goes into the social insurance fund, and out of that they get tangible benefits. They get their state contributory pension, they get maternity benefit, sick pay, and increasingly treatment benefit. What I'm saying is that if we are going to say to people that everyone should contribute, what we should do is link that contribution to something they actually get in return. Because what happens at the moment, and this would be, I suppose...
Did you get nothing back?
Well, is that it all goes into a pot and spending goes up and services don't improve.
You get your social services back. You pay the civil service.
I think when we talk about services, we should also include things like transport and health and education that people are on the receiving end of, but they're very poor by comparison to other European countries. The normal services that one expects and local authority funding for roads and parks and all the rest of it are very, very poor services for what we contribute.
I just want to come to Dan O'Brien and get your view of what Leo set out today in The Independent.
Yeah, well, I'd be more interested to know what the Minister's going to do in his own department, because on this principle of contributory, for example, okay, so in most Northern European welfare states, when you lose your job, you tend to get more money because you put in, so your income isn't hit that much, but it's tapered off over time. So that gives you an incentive then to get back to work, because you know that it's going to start falling. Okay, so you get more money in the beginning and then it's cut. Now, that is a completely sensible way of doing things. That's how the Nordic countries do it. I think that is something that should be done. Now, you know, why have we not moved in that direction? And just more broadly, you know, coming back similar to the Gorther situation, we are so bad at reforming things and saying, look, why don't we do things in the most effective way possible. The OECD, the European Commission, has been highlighting problems in our welfare system, disincentives to work year after year after year, and not enough is done to address these sort of things. So another classic example is how we help families, particularly lone parent families in particular. We give an awful lot of cash to lone parents. We spend a lot of money on it in direct cash payments, but we spend very little on healthcare, childcare. So that makes it difficult for lone parents to go back to work. And what do we have? We have one of the lowest rates of lone parent employment in Europe. So what we really, if we were designing the system better, we'd reduce cash benefits to parents and spend the money on childcare. Mm-hmm. And again, these are things that you know.
You have to talk about child benefits, reduce child benefits.
Okay, Leo, respond.
And stop giving it to millionaires.
Lest anyone think otherwise, social insurance is my department. Social insurance legislation is my legislation. It's the Social Welfare Acts, and the Social Insurance Fund is operated by my department. So this is very much my department's business. What Dan is talking about is bringing back something we actually had in the past, which is pay-related benefits, and they have as a norm in European countries. I've done some work on that. Some of it's appeared in the papers already. It's something I favour, but actually is very expensive and you have to prioritise first. So the priority was the introduction of new benefits like maternity benefit, which is done, the extension of benefits to the self-employed, which is now underway, the restoration of treatment benefits, which is kicking in from next week, for example. Pay-related benefits and moving in that direction would definitely be something that I support. But you can only do that over a number of years, and you do, in order to be able to make it sustainable, is you have to increase income to the social insurance
fund. But is it
fund,
not a priority?
Which is exactly what I'm proposing.
But you didn't mention it in your piece today, so we can only think that it's not a priority for you. You talked about income tax. You talked about social protection. You didn't talk about reforming social welfare.
I didn't, and I have loads of priorities, and I can't put them all in one article. They only gave me 800 words, but I promise you, there'll be lots of opportunities.
Because you had previously said that welfare should be a second chance, not a way of life.
Yes.
So that would tally with what Dan O'Brien is saying.
A second chance and a safety net. Some people need a safety net.
I think that this really deflects from what's actually going on. There's very, very few people for whom welfare is a way of life. Very few people. Hmm. Most people will spend their lives either in part-time work or in and out of work or in and out increasingly of precarious type of work. So there's a tiny and ever shrinking minority of people for whom welfare is a way of life.
Do you agree with that, Leo?
It portrays. I'll just finish because I think.
No, it's a very important point to put to the minister.
I do, and I'm staggered whether she meant to do it or not. She did concede that there is a small proportion of people for whom it is a way of life. It might only be 1 or 2% of people, but
I would say it's even fabulous.
But there are people we are now cracking down on. The point I wanted
to the minister is there were serious discriminatory measures taken during austerity against young people and against pensioners and social welfare. Is he going to restore them? Would that not be part of his reform to make welfare restoration a priority rather than looking at new measures that, he's saying will equalise the playing field discrimination against pensioners, there's discrimination against youth on welfare.
Okay. For example, I know it's modest, but we did have the first increases for 800,000 people last week, disabled, carers, blind widows, lone parents and others. On the lone parent reforms, we're bringing in subsidised childcare from September, change the disregards in January to allow working lone parents to keep more of what they earn. On the young people, we didn't give the full increase to young people who are on job seekers, but young people do anything else. We restored their rates to the full adult rate. So young people go back to education, young people take up CE schemes, take up two schemes, are in job seekers benefit, are young lone parents, young carers. We restored them to
move
the full
on.
Adult rate.
I'm going to come to you. Willie, quick point and then we'll come to Fiacre.
Look, I think whatever, I mean, I agree. I mean, there's a lot of unreformed work to be done on reform and pensions, lone parents, etc. But the point is that let nobody be under any illusion. For people who are forced to depend for a long period or a short period on welfare, they're not going to get rich. I mean, the rates of welfare are such that people can just barely eke out in existence from week to week. That's the reality. We have to bear that in mind. That's not such thing.
I was struck by the Leo's policy that's emerged over a couple of weeks. It's almost like Back to the Future for Fine Gael, because, you know, focusing on the marginal rate and the threshold at which people enter the higher rate of income tax was Fine Gael policy around circa 2014, 2015, before they had this obsession with abolishing the USC. That was almost like a diversion they went on for the general election. And while the PRSI related stuff, I think, was in your manifesto last year to a certain extent, it's almost what Leo is proposing is acknowledging that that general election policy last year was a massive blunder and they misread the public. I think the clamour for that came from the backbenches and possibly elsewhere in government, but certain people in Fine Gael, I think, probably acknowledged that it was a bad idea, a bad policy. And I think what Leo is doing is tacitly admitting that, or not even tacitly, he is admitting it, I think, by saying that that was too blunt a political instrument and people didn't buy it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that from the election results, don't we? The overarching thing, of course, overreaching this entire conversation, is the fact that Enda Kenny is still in situ. And your own paper, Pat Leahy, political editor in the Irish Times today, saying that nothing is getting done in government because of the limbo situation we're in now. Everything is on pause.
That's true. I was having a couple of conversations with people around the system myself during the weekend. I think the point makes that Pat makes in his piece this morning is very valid, that people are afraid to bring forward new ideas to progress existing schemes because they don't know if they're going to be in situ in 6 or 8 weeks' time. If it's Leo Varadkar or Simon Coveney who's Taoiseach, they're going to have a new cabinet. So there's a reluctance among the ministers and amongst the civil service to progress with the work that's on their desk at the moment. Mm-hmm. We had a situation last year over a number of weeks where we had a government, but we had negotiations to have a replacement for it in place. It's almost like a shadow of that. We have a situation where this leadership campaign looks like it's going to begin after the Maybank holiday weekend. Can't be entirely sure of that. And this has been dragging on since the night when Leo and Simon got up and challenged Enda Kenny at the PP meeting. Everybody knows the change is coming, but nothing has been done while that change is taking place.
Yeah, I mean, it's an internal party matter. That's what you will say. But if nothing is getting done, it concerns us all. If you won't put the push on here.
I don't accept the thesis that nothing has been done. We've had 20 acts of the Oireachtas pass through the Dáil an Seanad since the government was formed. The social
but you must accept there's reluctance from ministers and from people in the system to do things, to initiate big ideas now, because they don't know if they're going to be there. And it's because it's dragging on for so long that this kind of stasis has taken hold.
Are they used to introducing big ideas and making great changes?
Is that true? For example, minister's opponent is working through the childcare scheme. The legislation will go through in the next number of months. It's intended to be in place for September. That's a big change, giving people subsidised childcare. The budget tax changes came into effect in January. The welfare and pension increases came into effect in the last couple of weeks.
There are policy decisions that have already been made.
For example, just ones that are being made now, you know, Minister Bruton's changes that are coming through on school admissions, you know, that legislation is working through.
What is Willie O'Dea see happening?
Well, a lot of nothing. I have to remind the public that a lot of those policy changes we're talking about, improvements for pensioners, people in welfare, etc., have arisen because of the supply and confidence arrangement. We insisted on those. Look, basically, I read what Pat Leahy
said in the Irish manifesto.
Well, thank you for being converted after five regressive budgets, and eventually you had a progressive one, and you said it was the first progressive one in 5 years by your own admission. Look, a new Taoiseach, I mean, Enda Kenny said that he wouldn't lead Fine Gael into the next election, and whether that was wise or whatever, I leave others to judge, but the fact is he said it. Now, that means that, you know, he occupies the position of Taoiseach, so a new Taoiseach means a new government. I mean, whoever is elected Taoiseach, whether he be he or she, I don't want to exclude any aspirants, they will appoint their own government. It's a new government, effectively. So, you know, if I'm a minister in an old government that's going to come to an end in 4 weeks' time or 6 weeks' time or 8 weeks' time or whatever, I'm not going to embark on any new huge venture that might make me unpopular in the short term but would have longer term benefits. I mean, it's against human nature.
There's probably a responsibility on behalf of maybe Leo, Simon Coveney and Francis Fitzgerald that if this drifts further than post the April 29th EU Council summit, Taoiseach has kind of indicated he wants to go to that summit, lay out our Brexit negotiating position, which is a valid viewpoint. He has done a lot of diplomacy in recent months. Perhaps he should see that through. But if we get a situation...
It's 2 months away.
But if we get a situation where he arrives back from that summit and he kicks it down the road a further couple of weeks, then I think those who want to lead the party and the country need to show decisive action and say, look, this has gone on for too long. This has to stop and we need to put a stop to this now. Because
we're not talking about the bus strike,
because
and we're
there'll
not
be too
talking
much drift
about
after that, and
charges
has to stop
and other
after,
issues that are important.
It has to stop after the Maybank holiday weekend. There has to be change, or else it's going to be drift. Yeah.
Well, nothing's getting done, Breed. Should we not be talking about it?
Well, I don't think it makes any difference who the leader is. They just need to get on with whatever it is internally.
But if Pat Leahy is right and the pause button has been pressed on doing anything in government, we should all be concerned.
Well, let us, from the outside, the opposition and the media, stop focusing on it and make them put the pause button on the other way and put the pressure on them to deal with the bus strike, to deal with water charges, to deal with the housing crisis and the homelessness crisis. It is absolutely appalling what's going on with that crisis. It is just getting worse and worse by the day, despite all the announcements by Coveney. And I cannot believe that I'm sitting beside a former minister for transport. There's a national transport strike on and the current minister for transport refuses to do anything about it.
Okay, I'm going to come back to that, but I have to take this quick break. We'll talk about the bus strike after this. I was just telling our panel that we've about 2 minutes left to deal with the bus strike, which is not enough time. Dan, we heard Breed saying before the break that Shane Ross should intervene. What do you think?
Generally, look, it's very difficult for everyone involved, and I'm always reluctant to sort of wade into disputes. But, you know, just on the broader picture, there's a really important role for the state in many areas, health, education, even buses in cities. It's not clear to me why we need public sector workers driving buses outside the city. Britain did away with theirs decades ago. You go to developing countries, you get a bus station, there's competition. It's not clear to me there's a market failure that requires public servants to drive buses. So I'm just not sure there's a logic to have the system as we have it now.
Well, what about Cork City, Galway City, Limerick City? They're all driven by
within the cities. But most countries, when they have their national network of buses, it's a private market because it's a relatively simple thing. Within cities, there's issues around routes, stops, traffic management. But between cities, most countries now there's not a market failure that requires a government service.
Well, it's not true that they have always had. I go to Sweden frequently where my sister lives. I used to work in Germany. Public sector companies run the bus services in between cities and in between towns.
Well, as I say, Britain doesn't, for example. I was in South America recently.
It's not exactly a great model of public transport.
That model wouldn't work in rural Ireland, Dan. Intervention by the minister, yes. You see, this dispute it's not just a minutiae of the dispute itself. There's also policy changes needed which form part of the dispute, and that is within the purview of the minister. Okay. So he should be.
So it's not just a checkbook he should intervene
with. It's not just a checkbook.
It's the role of the National Transport Authority. solidarity.
Absolutely,
and it is the future for public transport.
Et cetera. Yeah.
It is a question of what sort of contracts we want our workers working under, and studying how the private sector actually treats its workers versus
my time is gone. So, Leo, really quick word on this.
This dispute will be resolved. These disputes are always resolved.
With or without the minister?
Not with the minister, with the bodies that exist to do this, the Workplace Relations Commission and
the
Labour Force.
Transport has nothing to do with the national transport strike. Right. An extraordinary situation.
Well, I didn't say that, but I said we have a mechanism to deal with these disputes.
Our conversation,
and it's a successful mechanism in every dispute in the past.
This conversation might continue past 2 o'clock, but unfortunately we can't. Next Saturday we'll be coming live from Dundalk. We'll be discussing Brexit and its effect on the border, trade, economic and political future of the country. We'll have Minister Charlie Flanagan, Gerry Adams, Stephen Donnelly and Geoffrey Donaldson, to name but a few. If you'd like to join us at the Oriel Centre in Dundalk, then email saturday@rte.ie. For now, though, have a great weekend. Saturday with Clare Byrne was produced by Annette Egan. The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan. The sound supervision was by Sheila Nivouille. The series producer is Kay Sheehy.